Andrea Dworkin is a radical feminist. She's had a profound impact on feminism in America. She's most famous for her struggle against rape, child molestation, prostitution, prison conditions for women, and pornography. She's one of the most talked about feminists of our time, and today we talk with her about her new book called Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. Andrea Dworkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Violence against women seems to drive your activism. How did this become so central to your life and work?
Well, when I started out writing about violence against women and exploring it, I would say it was marginal to the women's movement, and I thought it was important, but a lot of women didn't think it was important. Some women were working on it, but lots of women weren't, and they thought that it was very much a diversion. And now I'm happy to say that it's a central issue in the women's movement. And there aren't too many women in the world, and I do mean in the whole world, who are not working on violence against women. Because if violence against women is taken seriously, it's the only way of taking the status of women seriously. It's the only way that the status of women can really be addressed. You can't have equal status if you're being raped or if you're being battered or if it's all right to prostitute you. There's no equality that you can find in having those terrible things happen to you.
And did some of experiences in your own life in terms of violence really impact how you worked on violence against women issues?
Yes, certainly. I had been a battered wife and married to a radical provo in the Amsterdam Provo movement. And I really found feminism when feminists in Amsterdam helped me to escape from my battering husband. And as I did that, I found out more and more about violence against women and more about what it takes to escape it and what rape is like inside marriage. And I got a better vision of prostitution as well.
Why do you think there is such a huge amount of violence against women in terms of rape and incest and child molestation? What do you think is happening in the world and society such that that happens so much?
Well, first of all, it's happening because it's easy, because men can do it without any repercussions. Women don't strike back. Women don't retaliate. The laws don't allow women to retaliate, and I think that that's a really big reason.
What do you think we could do today, men and women both, to stop violence against women?
Well, I think we need better laws. We need better, there's a list of things. I mean, we need better rules of evidence. We need a judicial system that isn't just based on taking care of the defendant, but has something to do with taking care of the victim. We need a conviction in our hearts that it is an atrocity to beat a woman or to rape a woman. And we need to mean it so that when a woman is hurt by a man, he then is retaliated against one way or another, either through vigilante violence or through the justice system.
Tell me what you mean about vigilante violence. What are you suggesting? Who would be part of the vigilante justice?
Well, I think that when a woman's been raped, she has a right to retaliate. I have believed this for a long time. I spent most of my political life as a pacifist and worked very hard as a pacifist to try to stop violence in all of its forms. But what I think now is that since the justice system is so absolutely callous when it comes to dealing with violence against women, since the justice system won't do it, I think that a woman who's raped has a right to retaliate with a gun, with a knife, with any means that she has. Because I think that it's horrible to have to live in a world where you can be raped and do nothing about it.
Do you mean at the time of attack she would retaliate, or that she could hunt down her her abuser later and find him and then hurt him?
Both.
I guess I'm kind of surprised that you would say that, because of your history of dedication to nonviolence, and one could say that perpetuates violence if women also start violating men.
Yeah, I mean, it's come to me in my work when I started to do work on pornography. And I remember writing a chapter in my book, Pornography, Men Possessing Women, on the Marquis de Sade and all the women that he hurt, including some of whom he killed. And it seemed to me that if the first woman had retaliated, the second woman wouldn't have been hurt, and the third woman wouldn't have been hurt, and the fourth woman wouldn't have been hurt, and so on and so forth. I mean, I just think that it's obscene to allow violence against women to go on as if nothing is happening. And I think that we need to understand that violence against women is egregious, and that there's nothing that justifies it, and nothing that makes it acceptable. And most of us don't really believe that, because if we believed it, we would do something about it.
Do you believe that vigilante justice would be justified in non-sexual crimes also, in cases of murder or other, from men to men?
No, not in the same way, because I think that crimes against women happen because men don't believe that there will ever be any payback. And in order for them to change their minds about that, there has to be payback.
We've seen over the last few weeks in the press that a lot of Roman Catholic priests have been charged with child molestation going back 30, 40 years. I'm wondering if you think that now, because of the extreme attention on the priests molesting, we're getting a lot of stories from boys, do you think that will change how child abuse of girls is treated?
I think that child abuse of children will be taken more seriously because we're talking about child abuse of boys. I think that when anything is done to boys, it's taken more seriously than anything that's done to girls. And I feel for those boys. I think, though, that when they stand up and they have something to say about child abuse, they say it and people listen. Whereas when girls have something to say, they say it and nobody listens. I mean, there are so many girls missing, just missing. Nobody knows where they are. They disappeared. Nobody knows where they went. When I travel a lot across the country, I open up the local paper wherever I go, and there's always a story about a girl who's missing. And it's just unconscionable.
And why do you think we believe boys when they say things and we don't believe girls? Like, even if we hear that someone's house has been broken into and their TV was stolen, we believe them. But why do so many people not believe women when they say they've been raped?
It's a very deep prejudice against women. It's a belief that women don't tell the truth, generally speaking. and certainly don't tell the truth about rape or battery. And because the legal system is premised on the fact that women don't tell the truth, it's very hard to get justice for women.
Do you feel that violence against women is enough at the core of the contemporary women's movement? Are women paying enough attention to it today in the women's movement?
I don't know how you could pay enough attention to it, but no, I don't think women are paying enough attention to it. I think that women believe that the women's movement in the past dealt with it, and that now that's over. You know, we're done with it. We've done what we can do. And that's not true. We're just at the beginning of dealing with it. I mean, whether we're talking about the courts or we're talking about women walking down the street or whether we're talking about acquaintance rape and violence against women who are known to their rapist or abuser. So I believe, really, that it's almost impossible for women to get any kind of retribution.
And I want to ask you about your sense of the women's movement now. Do you feel supported over the last 30 years in your work by the women's movement?
Well, I have. When I travel, I do. I meet a lot of young women who do this kind of work, who work against sexual abuse, especially on college campuses. And what I see is that the media pays no attention to them. That, you know, on college campuses, they're organizing a lot the way my generation organized around Vietnam. And yet, there's very little attention paid to them.
You're famous for saying that all sex is rape, and it's mentioned in the first paragraph of your press information about your new book. What did you mean by that statement when you first said it, and how do you feel about it today?
Well, I wrote a book called Intercourse about how intercourse is a form of domination, the most common form of domination that men use against women. And I didn't actually say all sex is rape, but I do believe that intercourse is one of the main forms of domination that women have to be aware of and have to know about. And I think that women need to have a belief in themselves such that they do not have intercourse when they don't want to. And a lot of women who are married have intercourse when they don't want to.
So are you opposed to the intention behind the man wanting intercourse or to the actual physical act of intercourse?
I don't oppose the physical act of intercourse except when it's done against a woman's will. The problem is that a woman's will is so often overlooked. And when it's overlooked, it turns then into an act of rape. And I think that many men don't understand or care about the fact that they're overlooking a woman's will when they want to have sex with her and she doesn't want to.
So what I really hear you saying is that you oppose rape, but not intercourse where both people agree to the act.
Yeah, that's correct.
And let's talk a bit about your perspective on men. Early in your book, there's one point where you say that you are determined to live without men. But later you mentioned that you've lived with a man for 27 years. How have you reconciled these two perspectives about men?
Yeah, well, I think what I said was when I came back from Amsterdam and I was very poor and I was trying to work as a writer and live as a writer, and someone helped me get an apartment, and I bought one spoon and one fork and one knife and one plate because I wanted to learn how to live without men. And I did learn that. And I met my friend. We both walked out of the same show. It was a benefit for the War Resisters League. And we were both appalled by the sexism of the benefit. And we walked out, and we were the only two people who did. So that's how we met. And I had a very hard problem to solve. Someone had asked me to go and talk to somebody who was in prison that they thought might be innocent of what they had done. And I went and I talked to him, and I thought he was guilty. And regardless of whether he was innocent or guilty, he was very proud about beating up women. And I had no doubt that if he got out, he'd beat up more women. So I really didn't want to write the piece. And yet I had a lot of trouble separating from my friends on the left who thought that I should write the piece. So I asked a lot of people what they thought. And this friend I asked what he thought. And he said, well, it's clear that you don't want to do it, isn't it? So don't do it. And it was clear that I didn't want to do it. And so I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. And you've lived with him now for the last 27 years?
Right, yes.
I also have to ask, of course, about pornography, because you're very famous in terms of your opposition to pornography as being women-hating. But there was also a movement of some lesbian feminists in support of pornography. How have their arguments impacted your thinking about pornography?
Well, it hasn't impacted my thinking about it at all, except to the extent that I can see how much inside the pornographers have colonized women, how much we agree with the kind of hate that the pornographers spew towards women, and that we're not willing to fight that. We agree with it. And so that concerns me deeply.
So would you say that the lesbian feminists who support pornography have just internalized self-hate, and so they have, I guess you could use a term like false consciousness. They're not really aware of what their support of pornography means?
Well, I don't know if it's false consciousness or not. Let's say it's true consciousness, that's what they believe about women and about themselves, and that I don't agree with them about either women or themselves. I think that they're worth much more than they think they're worth.
Do you reject all forms of pornography, or is there a way to create feminist pornography?
Well, I think that if there is a way to create feminist pornography, it's a lot of wasted time. I mean, we have a situation in which women are poor and their children are poor. And women are not well educated, and their children are not well educated. And trying to figure out how women can create pornography is one of the least important things that I can think of.
And so the focus that women should be having is on getting educated or getting jobs or getting their children? I mean, do you have really a kind of economic analysis of what women should be doing?
Well, it's not an economic analysis per se, but I mean, it is the fact that poverty will drive women into pornography and poverty will drive women into prostitution, and that when women are desperate for work and money, the world of prostitution sounds good to them. And yet it's a venal world. It's a world in which women are hurt all the time. And I hope very much that women could join together and do something other than think about how to make pornography.
And you yourself fell into prostitution. Can you tell us how that happened to you?
Well, I was a teenager, and I was fairly rebellious, and I ran away from home a lot, and I would run up to New York to try to find poems, and I was just mad about poetry, and I didn't have any money, and I'd take the bus, and I would always be amazed that if you touched men in certain places, they adored it and would give you money for it. And so that's really the beginning of how I fell into it. And then in my other years, I mean, I did it when I was in high school, and then when I was in college, it also was something that I did. And at the moment that I became a feminist, I started thinking about, why am I doing this? Why am I doing it, and how am I doing it? And when am I going to stop doing it? And I made a decision that I would never do anything that wasn't with my own money again. And as a result, I became very, very poor, but it was a good decision.
I want to talk a little bit about the sense of the book. When I read it, there's such a strong woman. There's such an independent woman and girl. The picture is a strong-willed, opinionated, and amazing fighter. And at the same time, there's a lot of sadness and grief and loss. And I want to get at both sides of that. Where did your incredible strength come from in your will? For instance, you tell a story about the school when you were a child wanting you to sing Silent Night, and you refused to do that. And it sounds like the school really pressured you to do that. How was it in sixth grade that you had so much strength of will?
I don't really know. I mean, I just believed that they had no right to force me, and that I was Jewish, and Silent Night was part of a Christian holiday, and that it lacked self-respect for me to sing it. And so I wouldn't. And you're right. I mean, they put me in a room and closed the door. And then one of my drawings that was on the bulletin board, somebody wrote kike on it, and I didn't know what that meant, but I persisted and found out. And all through my younger years and then all through going to college, I had a very strong will, and I did what I wanted to do. And it's one of the reasons why I don't think that that prostitution is something that shows the will of women, because I've been through it, and I would say it's the thing that least showed my own will.
And the sadness and grief that emerge in your book, where does that come from?
Well, I met a lot of women in the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years who were prostituting and whose lives were much harder than mine in prostituting. And I felt really sad at the circumstances that they were in. And then, you know, there's always when you're... when you're trying to win something and you lose something, you always feel a little bit of sadness and a little bit of grief. So it troubled me very much that we lost so many things in the women's movement. We tried so hard to win for women, and we lost a lot of battles.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Talk of the Bay, and we're talking with Andrea Dworkin, who has just written a new book called Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Militant Feminist. Andrea Dworkin, at the end of the book, you write about being depleted. You say, I think I've pretty much done what I can do. I'm empty. There's not much left, not inside me. And from what you've just said, it sounds like this emptiness has come from hearing about so much violence against women, would you say that that's the source of the emptiness you describe?
Well, it's a very big part of it. To meet women all the time who have been hurt, whether it's through rape or battery or prostitution, who have been hurt. I mean, it's terrible. It's just terrible. And people can say that they're against it. They're against rape. They're against prostitution. They're against battery. But what do they do that's against it? You know, how do we find out what they do that's against it? Or are they just against it because it's easy to say that you're against it, but you don't really do anything to stop it?
Could one say, though, that then working in the women's movement or working on violence against women's issues is so depleting because it is so painful to hear about these horrendous crimes? Then how would you advise other women to do the work to fight violence against women and yet not suffer from this extreme depletion such that they don't have the energy to do the work?
Well, I think that it helps if women work together. And, you know, writing's a very solitary endeavor. And I think it's very worthwhile if women work together. You get a lot of strength from that, a lot of energy from it. And when you're tired, you should rest. And I didn't understand that, so I got too tired.
What do you do now, then, to replenish yourself?
Well, I'm not sure what I do. I try very hard, though, to be allies with my friends and, you know, do what we can to make the world a better place for women.
You also write a lot about music, about jazz and Billie Holiday and classical symphonies. Does music feed your soul?
Yeah, music is really important to me. I listen to music when I write, and music feeds my sense of art as well. I mean, it feeds my sense of form and my sense of identity as well. So it's very important to me.
And what role does writing play in your life?
The major role. I like writing very much. I love doing it. And, you know, the hard part of it to me is to be dealing with the publishing and the marketing of a book, but not the writing of it. That's the best part.
What happens to you when you write? What happens psychologically such that it feels it sounds nourishing to you?
Well, it's, I don't know if it's exactly psychological. It's more like your consciousness expands, and what you know seems to expand. It's wider than psychologically. It's a kind of super consciousness that you get when you're writing and that you can live with for the course of the time that you're writing.
What are you most proud of accomplishing in your work in the women's movement?
Well, I'm very proud about having written with Catherine MacKinnon the ordinance that made pornography into a civil rights violation. I'm very proud of that. And I'm proud of my books. And I'd say that's it.
You seem to be passing the torch on to young women now to take up the women's struggle. Do you feel confident that young women are capable of running with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hear all of this stuff about how young women are, you know, doing their own kind of feminism. And what I see at different college campuses is that women are very activist, especially against sexual violence. And young women are doing a lot of things. And the difference is that the media is not covering what young women do. And that's a shame.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much. I'd like to thank our guest, Andrea Dworkin, author of over a dozen books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, including her latest book entitled Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. Andrea Dworkin, thank you for being with us and for your hard work on behalf of women.
Well, thank you so much.